This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the December 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. I haven't done that for a while, and since there has been so much going on in the world that some of you, I am sure, would like to share your views about, I'm going to open the phones to get your takes on the world on my next program, December 27th. Russia always seems to be in the news, both real and fake these days, but Vladimir Putin's announcement of a sizable drawdown of Russian troops from Syria on Monday came as a surprise to the West, particularly Washington. He made the announcement at the Hemi Meme Air Base in Syria's coastal province of Latakia, the heartland of Syrian President Bashar Assad's Alawite minority. Accompanied by Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin said the Russian and Syrian armies had achieved the mission to destroy ISIS, quote, one of the most capable groups of international terrorists, end quote, in just over 2 years. It was Putin's first trip to Syria and comes as the government's forces have retaken control over most of the country under the protection of Russian air cover. Ironically, it was just last week that the Pentagon announced that instead of the 500 U.S. troops that the Obama administration told us were deployed in Syria, the actual figure has been closer to 2,000, if we were to believe them now. The new total counts service members on short-term deployments who are not included in the troop numbers announced by the Obama administration, who are engaged in support of Kurdish and anti-government Arab militias fighting the Islamic State in northern Syria. A critical but rarely mentioned difference, at least in the U.S. press, between the presence of Russian and U.S. forces in Syria is that the Russians have been asked to intervene by Syrian President Bashar Assad to help defend his government from foreign-sponsored efforts to overthrow it, including the United States. While there is no legal basis for the presence of even one U.S. soldier in Syria under international law or arguably American law. That's unless one believes that the approval given to President Bush by Congress to respond militarily to the events of 9/11 16 years ago was an open-ended mandate for W and his successors to send U.S. troops and launch attacks anywhere on the planet without seeking further approval from Congress, which the War Powers Act of 1973 requires. Obama and now Trump have taken full advantage of the media and the public's lack of concern for what the U.S. military does overseas and the unwillingness of both parties in Congress to challenge it. The media and Congress have bigger fish to fry, namely Russiagate. Quote, the Russiagate hysteria has spread beyond simply a strategy for neutralizing Donald Trump or even removing him from office into an excuse for stifling U.S. dissent that challenges the new Cold War, end quote. That is a quote from what veteran reporter Joe Lauria wrote in a recent article on a consortium news site, one of the few that has questioned the widely held opinion that Vladimir Putin personally oversaw a campaign that would disrupt the American presidential elections and put Donald Trump in the White House. On December 4th, Lauria wrote a long, disturbing article for Consortium News, How Russiagate Rationalizes Censorship, in which he describes how liberal websites like HuffPost, formerly Huffington Post, and organizations dedicated to press freedom like Fairness and Accuracy in Media, or FAIR, and the American Civil Liberties Union have abandoned their principles, legitimizing censorship, and joined the Russiagate mob. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Joe Lauria about his article and what is fast becoming the new McCarthyism, so stay tuned. Well, Donald Trump, since campaigning for the White House, has made no secret of his hatred of Muslims, not simply dislike, but unrestrained hatred, excepting, of course, those in Saudi Arabia who happen to have more money than he has and whose friendship he covets. He also made no secret of his affection for Israel and his equally pugnacious Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and he certainly does like American Jewish billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who dropped $25 million into Trump's presidential war chest after the resident promised to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv. Such a move has, in fact, been required by a law passed by Congress in 1995 on the urging of AIPAC, Israel's unregistered lobby, but it included a waiver that the U.S. president must sign every 6 months if he or she believes that doing so would be damaging to America's Middle East interests. Every president since Bill Clinton, under his administration, the law was passed, has signed that waiver, as did the Donald the first time it came to his desk. He, in fact, did so again this time, we were told, but for logistic reasons, his office noting that it will take some time to plan and build a new embassy in Jerusalem, which he publicly recognized last week as Israel's capital, becoming the first and only head of state to do so. Whereas his counterparts throughout the Middle East, as well as Israel's allies in Europe, expressed their dismay at Trump's breaking with the consensus that the final status of Jerusalem should be settled through negotiations between the Israelis and Palestinians, Israel's outspoken internal critic, Gideon Levy, welcomed it, as I did myself, for the same reasons. Theodore Trump, the visionary of the single state, Levy began his article, without Herzl's beard or Basel, the site of the first Zionist Congress, Donald Trump may become the founder of democracy in Israel-Palestine. Just as his vulgarity and sexism boosted the Me Too movement, his blatant bias toward Zionism and the occupation might create a backlash that could affect the only remaining conceivable solution. Sometimes you need a defiant bully to shake things up. Trump's the guy, wrote Levy. We should thank this dangerous man. He tore off the disguise and put an end to the masquerade. Trump told the world the truth. The United States is not an honest broker. It never was and never will be. It is the greatest collaborator with the Israeli occupation, supporting, arming, and funding it. It wants the occupation to continue. It never recoiled from it and, of course, did nothing to end it. Before Trump, it also mocked the world, the endless peace process that never led and was not intended to lead to anything but the perpetuation of the occupation. Countless purportedly balanced peace plans that America never tried to implement, countless purportedly neutral brokers, a majority of them Zionist Jews, and after all that, the appearance of an impartial peacemaker. Trump came out and put a stop to it, writes Gideon Levy. In deciding to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and only of Israel, he left no room for doubt. America is with the occupation, with Israel, and only with Israel. Of course, that's its right and the right of its president. Most Israelis are surely happy about it, but it won't bring about peace or relative justice. Trump also conducted the sad funeral of the two-state solution after its long decline into death. Now the heir must be found. In his horrifically one-sided announcement, Trump declared that there aren't two nations with equal rights in this land of two nations. There is one nation with one capital and all the rights, and another inferior nation with no rights. The other nation is not deserving of a state if it is not deserving of capital in Jerusalem, Levy goes on. That other nation must now recognize the situation and adjust its goals to the reality declared by Trump. The European Union will also have to adjust to reality and understand that winter is coming, says Levy. Up to now, the EU has been in America's shadow, its faithful servant when it comes to Middle East policy. Other than a few insignificant symbolic steps, it hasn't pursued a policy in keeping with public sentiment in Western Europe, most of which is opposed to the occupation. Perhaps Trump's extremism will shake the EU out of its complacency and spur it to more courageous and, most important, more independent positions. And maybe Europe, he says, will also stop invoking the two-state mantra now that a few of its heads of state have recognized that it's no longer viable. Perhaps Europe will take the lead on a new dialogue about equal rights for all. And whom do we have to thank? The President of the United States, says Levy. When the only genuine democracy in the Middle East is finally established, one day in the distant future, he should be invited. This American ultranationalist, he goes on, who would have nothing to do with morality or justice or international law or human rights or minorities or Palestinians, should be made an honorary citizen of this new just state. End quote. Well, those were the words of Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, writing in Haaretz, words that you will not find in any other U.S. media. While I agree with him that Trump's announcement exposed the peace process charade during which Israel has expedited the building of Jewish settlements, I don't share his optimism, as this will essentially change the situation in the direction he hopes. It would require a European intifada against U.S. domination and the international banking system, which the U.S. controls, and against its own Israel lobbies, which, while not an apex league, exert considerable influence over their respective countries' policies toward the Israel-Palestine issue and the Middle East in general. Moreover, the Palestinian Authority, which has openly collaborated with the Israeli occupation, is politically and morally bankrupt, and there's nothing in sight to replace it. A poll of 1,270 Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, conducted immediately after Trump's announcement, revealed divisions over what would be considered an appropriate response. Summarizing the results, the Ramallah-based Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research noted that, quote, while the largest percentage favor ending contacts with the U.S., submitting a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court, and a resumption of an armed intifada, the majority continues to favor responses that exclude armed struggle, despite the rise in support for such struggle during the past 3 months. Furthermore, it goes on, it seems obvious that the public does not think that its leadership shares its view on what is considered to be an appropriate response to the American step. That's a general way of saying that the Palestinian Authority President, Mahmoud Abbas, whose term of office expired 8 years ago, and it was openly and proudly collaborated with Israeli security in suppressing resistance to Israeli occupation, does not have the Palestinian people's support. The poll showed that 70% of the Palestinians want Abbas to resign, with the percentage being 64% in the West Bank and 80% in the Gaza Strip, on whose population Abbas, with Israeli cooperation, has enforced an economic blackout since February to force Hamas to surrender its rule to the Palestinian Authority, which it has. According to the poll, if presidential elections were held between Abbas, the imprisoned former Antifada leader Marwan Barghouti, and Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh, Abbas would receive 18%, Barghouti 41%, and Haniyeh 36%. Going head-to-head, Barghouti would top Haniyeh 58% to 37%. Since Israel is not about to release Barghouti, who was sentenced to 5 life terms by an Israeli military court for crimes allegedly carried out during the Second Intifada, the Palestinians are left with no truly qualified candidates who enjoy broad support from the people. It's not that there are no Palestinians capable of taking the leadership, but that a system of patronage has become so corrupt that there is no place for an outsider to emerge, and that's not surprising considering 61% of the Palestinians polled in the West Bank say that people cannot criticize the Palestinian Authority without fear of retaliation. That's the legacy of the late Yasser Arafat, who, while heading the first Palestinian Authority set up by the Oslo Accords, created 7 competing intelligence agencies, that's right, 7, while each month, according to the New York Jewish Weekly Forward, Israel deposited $8 million U.S. dollars into his private bank account. Listeners to Takes on the World on November 8th heard my guest, former CIA analyst Phil Giraldi, questioned the effectiveness of the U.S.'s highly touted missile defense system and suggested, based on its past failures and trial runs, that it would be unable to take down a missile launched by North Korea toward the U.S. That perhaps explains why, as I noted on an earlier program, there had been no attempt by the U.S. military to shoot down any of the missiles fired to date by North Korea. Had an attempt been made to do so and it failed, it would have been an unacceptable humiliation for the U.S. and for President Trump. Later in November, a missile was fired by Houthi militants in Yemen, under siege by the Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the U.S., toward the airport in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. The Saudis reportedly spotted the incoming missile and shot off 5 missile interceptors from a U.S.-supplied missile defense system to stop the threat. Our system knocked the missile out of the air, U.S. President Donald Trump later bragged. That's how good we are. Nobody makes what we make, and now we're selling it all over the world, end quote. But an investigation by the New York Times suggests that the incoming missile's failure to hit its president was a fluke, and the missile interceptors all missed. Essentially, the analysis indicates that the parts of the Houthi-fired missile that crashed in Saudi Arabia, brought down by the interceptors, fired from a Patriot Advanced Capability 3 system, did not hit the warhead as they were reported to have done. Instead, one of the interceptors probably hit a part of the missile tube that had detached from the warhead, which accounted for the debris found on the ground. The warhead continued to travel unimpeded to where it blew up outside the airport. Witnesses reported hearing the explosion, and satellite imagery uncovered by the Times suggests that emergency vehicles responded to that blast. The missile the missile, an old variety of the Scud, can be expected to miss by about a kilometer. The Pentagon's missile defense system, developed at the cost of millions of dollars, has been touted by defense officials as the most advanced in the world. It is the one that South Koreans and the 28,000 U.S. troops based there would be relying on to counter a North Korean missile strike that would surely come if Trump would be insane enough to order a preemptive U.S. attack on Pyongyang. This is Jeff Blankford, and thank you for listening.